This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
If you've ever wondered about the dark psychology behind history's most notorious murderers, Mind of a Serial Killer is the podcast for you. Find Mind of a Serial Killer on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. Thank you for being with us. We just got done speaking with the president and CEO of the St. Louis Area Food Bank. Your personal invitation from me to you to come see us tomorrow between noon and 3 at the St. Charles Ruler Foods as we do our annual Christmas food drive. Would love to see you. We'll talk more about that in a minute. I want to get to our guest. Very excited to have Andy McCarthy back on the show with us, a contributing editor at National Review, host of the McCarthy Report, and a Fox News contributor. Andy, welcome back. It's great to have you here.
Annie, great to be with you.
Thank you so much. I wanted to get your thoughts on the Daniel Penny trial. We've been covering the news as it's been developed, as are all those news organizations out there watching to see what happens. But a jury that couldn't agree on the first charge and a not guilty verdict on the criminal negligence. What do you make of the Daniel Penny trial in New York City?
Well, I've never been happier to be wrong. And I certainly was in the sense that on Friday, as you mentioned, it looked like the jury couldn't agree on the more serious count, which was the manslaughter count. Manslaughter is basically reckless homicide. And the other count was a negligence charge, criminally negligent homicide. So obviously, I thought if you had jurors who were at least one, maybe more, who were looking to convict Penny on the more severe charge, it was unlikely that they would acquit him on the lesser charge. But happily, I think what happened is after 4 days of deliberation, the shenanigans that the district attorney pulled at the end where, you know, after an 8-week trial telling the jury all of a sudden that the charge that the case has been centrally about is out of the case now and not to worry about it anymore, never mind after 4 days and 30 hours of deliberation, and then to make them come back on Monday to start all over again on another count, I think they were probably pretty steamed about that and saw through the ruse, and it took less than an hour for them to acquit on Monday. So I thought the best result Penny could get was likely to be a hung jury. So to see him get acquitted as it happens on both charges is great.
Yeah, I think that the way that this trial initially kind of paralleled the election with the developments that were taking place. And of course, the country's focus squarely centered on Donald Trump and Kamala Harris through the beginning of November. I was worried that it wouldn't get the national attention that it deserved. What do you think about Daniel Penny's trial, the fact that it was brought to begin with? It feels reflective of a society or maybe a justice system that is confused, at least from my layman's perspective, on who victims are and who criminals are and who the do-gooders are of the world.
Yeah, look, you're right about that. I grew up in New York City and I was a prosecutor, a federal prosecutor, not a state prosecutor like the guys who brought this case, but I was a federal prosecutor in Manhattan for many years. And when you're making decisions about exercising prosecutorial discretion, which prosecutors do in every case, right? Because we're in our country, you're not required to file criminal charges just because you're aware of criminal evidence. Prosecutors always have the discretion whether to bring the case or not. And that usually is a weighing of the public interest in going forward with the case versus other public interests. Here, not only was this a weak case, we're dealing with somebody who had a profound justification defense and who conducted himself heroically. But, you know, in New York, you have about 9 million people and fewer than 34,000 police. So normally, you know, when there's police presence, people don't commit crimes. But obviously, when you have so many people and so few cops, most, the vast majority of crimes that get committed, including violent crimes, are not going to be witnessed by police. Police are not going to be on the scene to provide assistance to people. And if valorous people who are capable don't come forward or feel like they're going to get in more trouble than it's worth to intervene when vulnerable people are under a threat or worse, or being attacked violently, the city becomes unlivable. It becomes very unsafe, because if those people can't come forward and the police aren't there, then that means the criminal element runs the streets. And I don't think, as a prosecutor, that's acceptable.
Yeah. We're speaking with Andy McCarthy, Fox News contributor, a fellow at National Review Institute. I think about, you know, if you're going to have a civilized society, those societal expectations have to have a pretty clear view on what is right and wrong. And there's always some gray area there, or context that makes it a little more complicated than the black and white of it. But when I think Americans, and I assume those people living in Manhattan, the look at what Alvin Bragg's attention is focused on, when we see in the wake of the United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson's murder, I mean, I don't know what this suspect, I don't understand how this is unfolding right now, but what I see surrounding this story is people who are forgetting that Brian Thompson is a father, is a human being, and he was gunned down, and somehow or another it's kind of just like a passing detail in a larger conversation about something that they used to justify this horrendous murder. It just seems like, for somebody like you who's invested in prosecuting crime and understanding the rule of law, which establishes and maintains order in a society, everything seems to be a little bit upside down right now.
Yeah, it does. And I have to say, in every case I ever prosecuted, I would always try to get into the head of the person that you're prosecuting, in part because the burden of the state or the federal government in a criminal case is to prove mens rea, to prove intent, to prove what the person's state of mind is, and also to give a... to give an accurate description to a jury of what happened. I always felt like you need to understand what happened before you can relate it to anyone else. So it's not strange to me that people go through the exercise of trying to rationalize why somebody did a terrible act or a really heinous crime. But somewhere along the line, we came to the place where you're not just doing that so that you can understand it better, but in some ways that the fact that you can rationalize it means that it somehow excuses it. And that's a ridiculous line to cross. We can't have a free, flourishing society if people take the law into their own hands in a violent way when they don't get their way. I'm here saying... talking about the prosecution of Penny, talking about the, other prosecutions that we've seen. I always think that, acts that are not intentional criminal wrongs shouldn't be in the criminal justice system. You know, these tragic things that happen that where nobody's really trying to hurt anyone else, but there's a terrible accident. And, we have a whole civil justice system that's for that, to assign fault when those sorts of things happen. And I don't like the idea of, taking something that's not a criminal case and trying to force it into the criminal justice system. But at the same time, it's even worse to have a situation where people think that if they don't get their way, or if somebody is in an industry that they decide in their own minds is an evil industry, that you can, take the law into your hands, be punitive with them in a violent way, and then rationalize afterwards that they had it coming. That's crazy. I mean, you can't have a society that way.
Yeah, not a civilized one for sure. Andy McCarthy speaking with us right now. We've had many conversations over the course of the months of time that Donald Trump has been trying to fend off some of what a lot of people refer to as lawfare. I think that the justice system on the whole, the conversation surrounding it has been very politicized. And Donald Trump coming in and naming people and nominating people into these positions where they can affect some change to level it out, it would be inappropriate for Donald Trump to swing the pendulum over to, you know, the Republican side of lawfare. I don't think any Americans want to see that. What have you thought about the announcements that he's made so far to his cabinet positions or to those areas where the justice system can get back to serving the business of the American people and law and order?
Well, I think well of the people that President-elect Trump has nominated to the Justice Department. And I like Kash Patel, who he's nominated for the FBI. I don't agree with him on all of his reform ideas. I have my own reform ideas that sort of aren't in the same place as his, but I think he was singularly right and did a great national service in basically exposing Russiagate for the sinister plot that it really was against Trump's presidency. And for that alone, I think he should come with a presumption in his favor. As far as the people at the Justice Department, I think Pam Bondi could be a fine attorney general. She's run one of the most consequential state attorney's offices in the country as Florida's attorney general. I do worry about people from outside the Justice Department, because the Justice Department, having been there for a very long time, is a kind of insular, almost arrogant place that is very conscious of its own ways of doing things. And if you don't know that place very well, as like Alberto Gonzalez found out when he was a state judge and attorney in Texas, and then was put in charge of the Justice Department under Bush, they can really undermine you if you don't know. It's a complicated building, Main Justice, and they're going to have a lot of smart, motivated people who are not friends of the Trump way of thinking and the Trump administration. And she's just going to have good people around her who know the building better than she does. And I'm a little bit concerned, even though I like these guys very much, that all of Trump's other major appointees at the Justice Department so far are lawyers who have represented him in his private capacity. The reason I worry about that is that if there's any case that comes up that Trump has an interest in, for whatever reason, and these are exactly the cases that he's concerned about, right? Because he's been through Russiagate back in 2016. He doesn't want to see that happen again. There's going to be arguments that those lawyers have to recuse themselves, because having represented Trump as a private lawyer in the past, they are not going to be able to be prosecutors in cases that affect him. So I'm a little bit concerned about that, but we'll just have to see how it plays out.
We're speaking with Andy McCarthy here on the Andy Frey Show. Check out his podcast, The McCarthy Report. I wanted to ask you about the news today that Letitia James, that New York Attorney General, said she's not going to drop the civil fraud case against Trump, said that it's a civil case and that can continue going on while he is the president. Of course, President-elect Trump has urged, for the betterment of the country, for her to drop that case. What do you think about Letitia James's announcement today that it's going to continue on as is?
I think that what Letitia James ought to worry about is whether the appellate division, the appellate court that's reviewing that case, they may be the ones who dropped the case. They seem to be very disturbed by it during oral argument. I think at a minimum, what's going to happen when that appeal gets decided is that there's going to be a significant slashing of the penalty against Trump and the other defendants and the Trump organization in that case. But some of the judges, in asking questions to the state, were making noises about whether James had appropriately applied the fraud statute that she applied to this situation, because the fraud case against Trump was built on this terrible New York statute that really applies to consumer protection matters. And she applied it to a situation which is completely the antithesis of that. She applied it to a situation where you have transactions involving sophisticated financial actors on both sides of the transaction who obviously know to do their own due diligence about risk. So it's not a case that you need the attorney general to jump in and defend. You know, you really think that the state of New York knows how to approximate risk better than a big New York financial institution, which is in the business of pricing risk? It's ridiculous. So if I were James, I wouldn't be talking so tough. I'd be worried about what the court is going to do to the case, not what she's going to do to it.
Well, I before I let you go here, I noticed on X, you're at Andrew C. McCarthy, and your picture here shows you in a Mets jersey. And I just wondered if you think $765 million for Juan Soto is a crime. From a St. Louis Cardinals fan here.
I have to say, one of the things about the Mets, it's funny you mentioned the Cardinals, because when the Mets were good in the 80s, which is the only time that they ever had like an overwhelmingly good team, every other time they were like the scrappy underdog kind of team. And they had a great rivalry with the Cardinals, of course, in the mid to late 80s. But what I worry about with Soto, and this is especially after this season that we just had, which is like, it fell out of the sky. You know, nobody expected them to be good. They were kind of lousy at the beginning of the year. And then all of a sudden, we're in the National League Championship, which no one expected. So it was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And having rooted for the Mets now for, I'm a little older than the Mets are, so that's how long. I'm going to miss the scrappy underdog. You know, no one's going to feel like you're a scrappy underdog if you're paying guys $700 million.
The great pressure of high expectations. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Well, we here in St. Louis are feeling like we're in a rebuilding process, and watching Juan Soto go to the Mets, it was like, oh, man, that's a steep one.
That's a great organization. If they're down, they're never down. They're never down for like more than a year or two, and then they're right back. So
we're gonna try to apply the 2024 scrappy Mets philosophy next year. I think we'll see how it goes.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, the scrappy is only cost you about $400 million, I think now. So
it's very economical. Andy McCarthy, thank you so much. Merry Christmas to you. We're grateful for your time that you spend with us always, and we hope you have a great holiday season.
Thanks so much, Annie. To you and yours as well.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Andy McCarthy, Mets fan. We won't hold it against him. And I refrained from saying pond scum right there. Did you see how well I handled that situation? Do the Mets, they know that. Mets fans know that we called him pond scum, right? That's obvious.
I think so. It was an insult as part of the rivalry.
It's the last time we ever interview Andy McCarthy. We're going to inform New York. It's not like New York's paying a lot of attention to what St. Louis is doing. I had to ask him that question there. Contributing editor at National Review and Fox News contributor. We got to get out of here, because when we come back, your senator, Eric Schmidt, and my adopted senator, Eric Schmidt, on the Annie Fry Show to talk about the Senate. What is the Senate going to look like with Donald Trump being the president? Is the Senate going to confirm Pete Hegseth, Kash Patel, this whole host of people that have to go through senatorial confirmations? Eric Schmidt will weigh in on that on the Annie Fry Show next.
Well, there's a lot to be done. First of all, you salute the commander-in-chief who got those 76 million votes and is going to chart the way. And I'll give him advice and counsel along the way. I'll just say what he told me. Return the Pentagon to the warfighters, Pete. Get in there and clean out all the social justice, politically correct garbage on top, and get back to lethality, warfighting, accountability, meritocracy, and readiness. And guess what? 95% of the people in that building in the Pentagon and that wear the uniform, that's all they want to do anyway.
Pete Hegseth talking about his nomination as defense secretary from Donald Trump to participate in the cabinet in that capacity. And of course, everybody's big question is, how will this Republican majority of senators react to Donald Trump's appointments? And we're excited to talk to your senator and my adopted senator, Eric Schmidt, on the Annie Fry Show. Welcome back, Senator. Thank you for your time today. It's great to have you back.
It's great to be back with you.
So when you hear Pete Hegseth there's a whole bunch of people that are, people are really wondering, are the Republicans in the Senate going to come together and confirm these nominations? What's been your experience among your colleagues and the excitement behind or worry about confirming some of these nominations?
I'm generally really positive about it. I think Trump has put together a slate of nominees for these important positions that share his vision. He ran on the idea of disrupting permanent Washington and sort of the status quo He wants people who are going to go in there and be reformers. A lot of things we can do in Congress, but there are a lot of things that are just cultural shifts that need to happen within the agencies, reforms that need to happen from leadership. And so you got to have people who buy in. And Pete Hegseth is one of those guys. I met with Pam Bondi, who was in my office today. I'm meeting with Sean Duffy later today. Was in my office last week. I'm actually on the Armed Services Committee, so that confirmation will run through the Armed Services Committee when we get back in January. I think he's in pretty good shape. I think they're all in pretty good shape, and they should be. There are very few examples, very, very few examples of senators from the same party of a president that just got elected rejecting cabinet officials. So I know that the liberal media wants everyone to believe that it's somehow a Republican Senate's job to dunk on President Trump. It's not. It's actually not. We have a role in the Constitution. It's advice and consent. But the president should have wide deference here on who he gets to pick for his team, his leadership team, right? He ran. He won the popular vote. He swept all the battleground states. And so I think all these nominees are in really good shape, and they should be.
You know, you mentioned about, you know, what the media, the left-leaning media, the Democrat punditry out there is trying to press upon the Republicans in the Senate to remind them of what their duty is here. And I think that that is one of the biggest complaints that Republicans within the party have had about the Republican Party for so long, which is you get handed the power to make the changes that you campaign on, and then you get it, and then you start doing things that the Democrats would never dream of doing. But especially in the Senate, it looks like the Republican Party, the representation for the Republican Party in the Senate is going to look a little bit different. The leadership certainly is. What do you think of comparing your time in the Senate prior to and coming up now as that leadership change has taken place?
Yeah, I think you just look at the last 6 or 8 years since really President Trump became the leader of the Republican Party. The composition of the Senate is changing, and I think that's a good thing. I think it's becoming a party. I mean, look, what I tell people, whether it was, you know, the leader race or any of this stuff, it's time for the Republican Party to reflect the values of our voters. And I think that the exclamation point that President Trump gave with this election, by winning a mandate to deliver, he has a lot more allies now, I think, in the Senate and the House than he did the first time around. He's also, I think, picking a cabinet that there's not a lot of daylight between where he's at and where they're going to be on important issues. And I think that's good. Like, that's why you run. That's why when you win, you can execute a vision. And like I said, you know, whether it's Pam Bondi or Pete Hegseth or Sean Duffy or Tulsi Gabbard or Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the president deserves the ability to move forward on the agenda he ran on and have people he trusts around him. And so I do think that that's where Senate Republicans are at right now. I expect that all these nominees will pass.
Senator Schmidt, when I have gone back, you know, anybody who, it's usually just the left-leaning media, they're freaking out about somebody or something, which usually means we're hovering right over the target, or at least the president is on his nominations, because they freak people out in all the right ways. It really seems to me like some of these nominees should have overarching bipartisan support. Then I go back and look at the votes that were taken over Joe Biden's nominations. There's a lot of Republican support in past votes for some of these people, like Merrick Garland. I think two people voted against Merrick Garland. I just don't understand even how it would be complicated to see these people be able to go through. And I'm wondering if you think there will be bipartisan support for many of Donald Trump's nominations.
I hope so. I think some people have even signaled that, some Democrats, and I hope that they hear these nominees out. Again, Donald Trump won. We have, you know, 53 votes in the United States Senate. Like, we should be able to. We don't need any Democrats' votes to do this. Sometimes you do. We don't for this. But having said that, I do think that they're, I hope the Democrats take the time to meet with these nominees, ask the questions. And you know, I think there will be some votes. I think, you know, Marco Rubio comes to mind. I hope Pam Bondi, you know, and hopefully there are many, many others. But I wouldn't be surprised if there is some Democrat support. I think it'd be a good thing. But we shouldn't rely on that.
Right.
That's why, you know, Republicans, we shouldn't rely on that. And you're right. What you're touching on, Annie, is exactly right, which sometimes gets lost in this town, which is why, you know, I'm home. I fly back and forth every week and stay very connected to Missouri, because when you talk to people, they articulate the same things that you're talking to. How come when the Democrats win, you know, they do big things and they all stick together? And we need to have that kind of mentality. We have a very unique opportunity for at least 2 years, hopefully 4 years. We've got the Senate, the House, and the White House to move forward on an agenda. And Trump was very clear about what this was. I spent a lot of time on the campaign trail, including the last weekend of the campaign. He never wavered from this. We're going to secure our border. There are going to be deportations. Like, he's going to do all the things he said he was going to do. We're going to be energy dominant. We're going to be respected around the world. And you're already seeing some of these things happen. I mean, he was in Paris this past weekend. You're already seeing leaders come down to Mar-a-Lago and address the concerns. And so I think we're already kind of down that road. And we have a responsibility, I think, to the country to get this country in a much better place than it's been the last 4 years.
Oh, we're speaking with Senator Eric Schmidt, and that's kind of what I had written down as my next question. In my lifetime, I'm 40 years old. I don't think I've ever been in a position to witness the transformative opportunity that is in front of Republicans in the next 2 to 4 years, not just to put everything back the way Republicans had it, you know, when Donald Trump was president the first time. But when you look at what Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy are doing with Doge, the actual concept of cutting government spending is kind of mind blowing for a millennial like myself, because we haven't seen that. It's only ever gotten bigger. How transformative and how forward thinking do you think the Republicans can handle this next 2 years?
I totally agree with you. So I'm 49. I've got you by a few years. But I remember, you know, when I was a freshman in college, sophomore technically, in 94, which was the Republican Revolution, right? It's the first time Republicans took back Congress in like 50 years or maybe longer than that. But Bill Clinton was in the White House, right? So like you didn't have the same opportunities. You really have to go back to Reagan and some of the big, bold stuff that he did. But I think this is different. I actually believe we have a much clearer view now of the things that we can address. I'm on that Doge caucus. I think it's exciting. There's going to be hundreds of billions of dollars exposed as wasteful. People are going to, you know, scratch their heads and say, how in the world is this possible? And it's our job to go fix it. I think we have a chance. And I feel so fortunate at my age to be in the United States Senate to be able to help with this, to kind of reset the dynamics. Or, you know, what we saw now, the Republican electorate, the base is broader. It's bigger. That's a good thing. It's working class folks. It's multi-ethnic. You have, you know, you just look at any demographic, Asian Americans, Hispanics. Trump did incredibly well with all of those groups, because they're hungry for somebody who speaks to their issues. The Democrats have been captured by this woke ideology. They're totally, you know, it's a party of, by, and for the elites. And so we have a real chance. And if we do it right, it can be, sort of a majority party, and not just for bragging rights, but like to actually do some important things. Like, there's no reason in the world, Annie, we shouldn't be the most energy-dominant country in the history of the world. And that means national security. It means economic security. It means jobs. There's no reason why we can't have a secure border. We absolutely can do that. There's no reason why 15 million people came here legally, other than the Democrats wanted it that way. We can shut that out, too. So I just think we're on the cusp of a new era of prosperity in this country, where we're secure. People feel good about being Americans again. They don't feel like, and the Democrats have got to figure this out. I think their self-reflection is, you know, the dose of self-reflection is being poisoned by sort of their disdain in many ways for so-called flyover country. They can't bring themselves to admit that they just talked over and talked down to so many people over the last 4 years. And people said, you know what? That's not the kind of America we want to live in. We love this country. We don't think that our kids should be raised to hate this country. And they spoke up loud and clear on November 5th. And now the task at hand is to get a cabinet in place and pass an agenda that, again, is reflective of where the American people are at.
Yes, get right down to the art of the business of what's going to take place. We're speaking with Senator Eric Schmidt. There's one other topic I wanted to address with you since I had the opportunity to have you on here. Of course, you served as a statewide official in Missouri as the attorney general here. You're a law and order guy. And I'm watching, the Daniel Penny trial, the verdict that came through there, but also the murder of the UnitedHealthcare CEO, and just very strange, some of the reaction and the justification in conversation throughout the media that's taking place. Like, a man lost his life, and if it's for a cause, there are some people who are kind of explaining it away. We've seen in New York City, in the wake of the Daniel Penny verdict, people really pushing back on that BLM kind of mentality that really got its legs here in St. Louis and Ferguson 10 years ago. And it just feels like what you were just discussing there, that we are on the precipice of an entire reset making America great again is a great way to talk about it, but a reset in our expectations from each other, societally, culturally, and law and order, and the appreciation of those who keep law and keep order is at the top of the list of how to restore that society. I'm wondering, in the wake of the Daniel Penny verdict and what's going on in New York City, what thoughts you might have on that.
Yeah, I mean, thank God for the way that played out. I mean, this was a guy that was trying to protect other passengers who were, you know, at risk. And the idea that those charges were even brought is embarrassing and, you know, could be described as much worse than that. But Alvin Bragg is just destroying people's faith in the justice system. But I do think when you have a verdict like that, I should say that, you know, he was not going to go to jail for that, is a bit affirming. I think, though, what you're talking about, and I've started to, I think it takes a little time to put all these pieces together, but I sort of view the last 10 years, take 2014 and that, was sort of a, we're going to look back, I think, in historians, if it's not AI generated by libs who control the algorithm, you're going to look back as a really strange time in American history. You've got this sort of Black Lives Matter movement. There's nothing more than cultural Marxism by another name. You had COVID and all the examples of government excess. And the Democrats felt so emboldened. It could only work, Annie. It could only work if they silenced the silent majority of Americans into believing that they couldn't speak up.
Yes.
Right? That they couldn't say things like, yeah, I know what a man is, and I know what a woman is, or that's wrong, or absolutely people should be punished for this. They tried to intimidate people, and they had this vast censorship enterprise as an enforcement mechanism. And one of the things I'm most proud of is that Missouri versus Biden case. It sort of lifted the veil. Musk buys X, or Twitter, now X. And people are no longer afraid, I think, in many ways, to speak the truth. I saw more yard signs. I saw more MAGA flags and yard signs, even in places in St. Louis County where I live. I think people are unafraid now, whereas before, the left was obsessed with controlling what you could say and what you could say, you know, and hear and see. And think of COVID. You couldn't go outside unless you were going to a Black Lives Matter protest, right? Like somehow COVID didn't exist if it was the cause that you believed in. I think we're going to look back on that and people are going to be like, what in the hell was going on? But I think we broke the fever. And President Trump led that charge, and I think it's all the more reason why we need to deliver on an agenda that works for, you know, more Americans.
Amen to that. Enough of the absurdity. It's time to speak out, and you can speak out with the rational common sense. And there's every time someone's willing to do that, there's so many people around going, yeah, what they said. And I think we're back. And you're a huge part of that in the United States Senate. And we're grateful for your time here on the Annie Frye Show. Keep doing what you're doing. We look forward to contacting you again soon.
We're so back, Annie. Let's go.
We're so back. That is exactly right. Merry Christmas. Bye-bye.
Merry Christmas. See ya.
I love talking to Eric Schmidt about common sense, because when you can articulate things in the way he does, which is speaking directly to the point, you know, talking about our AI lib overlords trying to rewrite history. When you think back about the last 10 years, it really has been, I don't know what 2014 was, but I guess it was when the Barack Obama stranglehold on the administration, you get 2 years out from the next election, everybody starts asking questions again, and the freak out that the left had, and really the tentacles of power that they were able to invoke in order to keep us from speaking our minds, from challenging thoughts based on our own perspectives. They had such great power, and we collectively need to be in a all hands in the middle, never again situation. We should be able to disagree. We should be able to challenge. We should be able to represent our own thoughts with our own mind. And we set that aside for quite some time out of fear. Never again. Not in my lifetime. Let's take a quick break. We'll get Ryan Wiggins back in the studio. The YouTube live chat poll, I haven't really mentioned this much today, if at all. But here's the question for you. And this is kind of broad, but I want to know, do you care if your favorite entertainers are good people? Yes or no? Now, entertainers, you're entertained by movies, by music, by sports, by art. I don't know. Whatever it is to you. Like, you know how they say never meet your heroes? Your entertainer of choice, that actor in the movie that you really like, you find out that they're a bad person. Is that a problem for you? We'd love to know what you think about this on the Annie Frye YouTube live chat. Do you care if your favorite entertainers are good people? Yes or no? We'll be right back. The OG Rock Mouse debut, I think, on the Annie Frye Show.
Yep. Gosh, you go through so many things in your career. That was a weird moment when I was Rockmouth. Everybody's like, oh, is it so magical working with Toby Mac in the studio? No, it's just business when you get to that level. You just go in and you do your part and you go home. A lot of times you don't even see the people.
Captain Planet says, gosh. What was that, Annie?
It was Rockmouth.
Quick Rick says on the Annie Fry YouTube channel, how's that Little Debbie snack box holding out, Annie Fry? It's become a snack drawer in our office. It is a community Annie Fry show drawer. Have you been in the drawer yet, Ryan?
No, I haven't. Because I went to the store on Saturday and bought a bunch of stuff. So
do you have your stuff here?
Still going through some of my own inventory.
So when you go to the second generation Little Debbie shop in Roxana, is that just for you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not saying I get nothing for the rest of the family, but most of it ends up here in my drawer, too.
The percentage of purchase that is for Ryan is
80%.
80%.
Yeah. There's some chips and things that I might, maybe some of their Amish snacks that I take home, but most of the Little Debbie stuff ends up here, which means I won't have to get into the community drawer for a while.
You did get into the drawer, though, because you had the nacho cheese Cheeto things.
No, she threw those to me yesterday during the show, and I was just eating them after the show when you came in.
So you didn't get them out of the drawer?
No.
I'll take a picture of the drawer and post it on our Facebook, Annie Fry Show Facebook. The YouTube live chat poll for today, if you want to come hang out with us there, we'd love to have you. Do you care if your favorite entertainers are good people? There was a lot of discussion this weekend about Jay-Z. Jay-Z is being sued by someone connecting him to the Diddy stuff.
Mm-hmm. It was a huge shock to me. I've always told my kids, be like Jay-Z.
Shush.
And now we had to have a talk.
What did that talk sound like?
I said, remember how I said, be like Jay-Z? And they were like, no. And I was like, oh, good.
Because that would be terrible advice. I really do want to know if they're good people or not. I don't need them to be like my version of good, but there's a collective understanding of things that we can all agree that are bad. I want to know if people are participating in those things. Am I boring you?
Yeah. No, they have too much power and sway to not care about that to me.
And are you using what you're getting out of this for bad things, if not evil things?
Yeah. I mean, a huge portion of these people came out and supported a political candidate. That's like changing world events. Mm-hmm. So, yes, you have a say in the way things go. Like, how many people didn't care at all about the election until Taylor Swift said, well, I want Kamala.
Wasn't the net summation of her endorsement of Kamala Harris that it helped Trump more than it helped Kamala?
No idea. I have no idea.
I've heard that.
Those are real reports that people were like, oh, knock it off.
People are over it. I will give them that. And I'm glad about that. But it doesn't mean they have no influence. They are the ultimate influencers.
Well, the YouTube question isn't specific to politics, but politics is definitely a way that you might be able to assess that type of a situation. But a lot of the discussion around the Diddy situation is that he's sitting in a prison right now because of what he's done, what he's been charged with, whatever. He's not the only person who participated in these things.
Yeah.
Actually, the premise of the charges are that it was a really large scale thing. And I want to, I'll ask Ethan about this later and let him speak for himself. But we were discussing this before the show and we were both like, we definitely want to know, but not 100% sure how much we want to know. But you want to know. And I said, like, I want to know what the headline is. And the details, maybe I don't need to, although I'll probably end up finding out what they are anyway.
It's the graphic details that you're like, I don't need to know every moment of one of the parties. I do want to know who was there doing illegal things and for how long, how much people knew, even if they weren't participating. I do want to know that. Because that does affect, I mean, all the Epstein stuff. It's the same thing. Who is the first person ever to traffic minors to nobody. Like, nobody's been charged in any of that. It's because of power and wealth and influence. And it's the same stuff that I'm so glad to hear Kash Patel saying, yeah, not on my watch. If I get in there, we're going to expose all this stuff. So great. I don't care who it affects. I don't care if it's Democrats or Republicans. But the answer to the poll is, yes, I do care about whether these are good people or not. Not because they influence me directly, but because they are influencers.
Will you not go see a movie because, like, okay, since Diddy's the one who's been charged and is in jail, let's say he's a movie star. Because I can't, like, I don't prefer his kind of music. So it's not like I'm going to stop listening to something.
Yeah.
If he were going to star in a movie that you were really excited to see, and he's in it, and he's going to profit from, you know, the $80 movie ticket or whatever it is that you got to pay, if he's going to profit from you participating in that, are you going to stop patronizing something because you found out that specifically Diddy, when you think about the heinous nature with which that is, if he's associated with it, are you out?
I mean, it's hard with Diddy because, like you said, I'm not really that into his stuff anyway. But with his level, that for the most part, the answer to your question is no. It's probably not going to impact me going and boycotting somebody because of what I know about them or what's out in the news about them. There is a line probably that I could get to and I'd say, I don't think so. But that line almost takes care of itself. It's like, if it gets that bad...
It's almost like the line is like, who are you hurting with the bad things you're doing? Because if it's other people and if it's children...
Yeah, and there are enough people that will already be boycotting it before it gets to my threshold that I don't know that those things are getting made.
What about you, Brad?
Yeah, it matters to me. And, like, I will boycott a movie because it's not that I'll boycott the movie, but if I go watch a movie and I can't suspend my disbelief and see the person playing a character and all I see is that person.
Then they're not entertaining.
Yeah, and they're not entertaining me and I'm out of whatever it is. Why am I going to spend money to go see that movie? So, yeah, it'll affect my consumption of whatever products they make.
I won't even go see any Dixie Chicks concerts anymore. Because
same
of what they said to my president, George W. Bush. I'm like,
you mean
no,
the Chicks?
The Chicks. I will not see the Chicks. You?
It was annoying to watch you think of that while Brad was talking and wait your turn to say that. You had such pride on your face. You're like, ooh, a Dixie like, Chicks ooh, joke. I'm in. I hope there's time left in this segment.
I know how this
land.
Segment's ending. It's going to be great. And it was.
I really love the Dixie Chicks. I can't stand the Chicks. And yes, they've segmented themselves to be two different groups.
Mm-hmm.
I still listen to the Dixie Chicks, but...
I won't even see Lady A.
I liked them too. Oh, tell us what you think on the Any Fry YouTube channel. Go vote. Leave your comment. We'll get to them at the end of the show. Don't go away.